Welcome to Delighting in the Trinity with Michael Reeves, brought to you by Union. This podcast brings you teaching and preaching from our archives, and you can find more resources, audio, video, and books at unionpublishing.org.
That we're serving. I'm a seminary president. In some countries, we used to call that a theological college principal, if that's what you're used to. It's the same thing. It's just that as we go more and more international, most countries don't know what a principal is. They think it's a high school teacher. So seminary president, theological college principal, whichever one you know. That's my perspective. And so as we look at theological education today, those are the glasses that I'm really reading through. So I want to apply this. I want you to see this as relevant to you if you're just about to start a PhD or you work as faculty in a university. I'm hoping this will be relevant to you, but you're hearing it through the voice of a seminary president. So let me talk a little bit. I'm going to give plenty of time for questions and interaction later, but if you really can't keep it in and you just need to say something, just interrupt. That's fine. I'm not fussed by that. Let me start by giving you something of the situation today and how it is a little different to how things have been in the past. One of the defining marks for the state of theological education today is the financial pressure that is on theological education. I find it interesting this week talking to a number of Christian leaders as they're talking about theological education, as they're interested in raising leaders in seminaries, talking to a number of donors, and there's a fairly common refrain that seminaries across Europe are financially fragile today, sometimes extremely fragile. And there are a few reasons for this. One reason is people can't afford the education today. And that in part is to do with the student debt problem. So we find a majority of our students, those who want to study theology, I'm thinking seminary, so I'm thinking those who are wanting to train to be church leaders in some sense. But it would also work for universities, that most of our applicants they're graduates, they've done a degree in something, which means almost certainly they've got some student debt at somewhere, and they probably haven't paid it all off, which makes it very difficult for them to put a job aside, whether part-time or full-time, and pay for tuition fees. And that's a big concern if people can't actually afford a theological education. Related to that, slightly more behind the scenes, this won't be a concern for usually students or faculty, but it's sort of thing that management need to think about, is that donors will tend to care more about immediate bang for your buck in mission, whereas investing in the future of robust and healthy church leadership is just a longer-term game, and you don't get so much immediate return where you can see, here's what we've actually achieved, here's the number of churches that we've planted. And so there's, understandably, there tends to be a bias among donors towards immediate mission, not mission sustainability through theological education. So students are struggling to pay, donors aren't picking up the tabs. There's a problem with the finances that we can't afford the education. Secondly, there is, I think particularly today, this is always going to be a challenge, but particularly today, there's an apathy towards education, particularly theological education. So not only a lack of money, but a lack of strong desire for theological education. This isn't universal by any means. I'm finding I get many, many men and women in their 20s, 30s who would like a theological education and simply can't afford it. But there is generally quite an apathy towards education, which comes, I think, from a few sources. So on the one hand, one of the problems of evangelicalism, I think globally, it's particularly virulent in the UK, is there is within evangelicalism a strongly anti-intellectual strand. And that comes from a few things. On the one hand, so I'm realizing I'm walking around and I'm probably making the cameras move. I'm sorry, I shall anchor myself now. That anti-intellectualism comes from a few things. That evangelicalism, we care about experience, the experience of knowing God. And it means that we can care about that the sweetness of our communion with God over the details of who God is. Of theology, but also I think there's a sense in evangelicals that the universities and high-level theologies is the domain of the liberal. And therefore, it's a dangerous place to walk into for evangelicals, and you don't really want to choose to invest time there. So I remember when I was looking at going to seminary myself, and I went to check out one particular college, and there was a friend of mine who has already started there, and he said, the great thing is you don't really need to do any theology here. You can just get stuck into student ministry. And that's what put me off that place. I thought, okay, well, he's a great guy, but this isn't the place for me because I want to study theology. But there was that strong sense that you really don't need to be doing that. And with those problems, a lack of desire for education and a lack of finances for education, a question is starting to be raised in quite a widespread way. Is the traditional seminary model unfit for purpose? And on the one hand, seminary presidents like me could moan and say, you know, people ought to stump up more and they ought to be more enthusiastic. But actually, there is a valid question here. Is there a bottleneck here in the traditional seminary model that if we want to be raising up hundreds, thousands of theologically educated, theologically robust church leaders, you can't have a model where you have to remove people from their location when they can't afford that, and you put a price tag on it that's simply out of their reach. And so we need to think through, is there a way to get all the benefits of a traditional theological college seminary education, the relational learning? That's a real benefit. It's learning in relationship, where you've got corridor time with faculty and with fellow students, you're learning together. That's all very important. Can you get that? Can you get the quality of faculty input while removing the geographical problem and the financial problem? And if you can do that somehow successfully, that means we smash the bottleneck and we can raise up more leaders for Europe. So there's that sort of question we need to be asking. How, amidst all the challenges of today, do we raise up the leaders that we need for the church today? How do we do that? And it means we need to think through creatively how we challenge the traditional model and have a model that's fit for purpose for today. And a reason, with a historian's hat on, a reason I think that is so very important is because I look at the history of the Puritan movement in the 17th century. Now, the heyday of the Puritan era was really the 1650s in Britain. And there you see so many of the Puritan great works, great substantial works of theology written, especially in the 1650s. In the 1660s, everything changed. And what happened from 1662 in a series of acts? Those who were not prepared to be part of the Church of England were excluded from going to Oxford and Cambridge universities. And what that meant was, now in the 1650s, John Owen, a great Puritan theologian, had been Vice Chancellor of Oxford University, and he meant Oxford to be the seminary for England. And in Cambridge, masters of colleges were thinking the same sort of thing. They wanted to raise up intellectual leaders and preachers for the reformation of the country. But when those who couldn't subscribe to the Church of England prayer book were removed from their education, what happened in a process of about 35 years, one generation, that great Puritan movement, its theological muscle wasted away. So the high point of the movement, around the late 1650s, to 1700, by 1700 the movement is dead. And it really took only about 35 years in there. And by the year 1700, the heirs of the Puritans either haven't had the theological education to be robust in their teaching. There are still one or two who are still benefiting from years past. But generally, you don't have the titans of weight theologically by the year 1700. And the other problem you see by the year 1700 is those who are not in the Church of England, the heirs of the Puritans who were not in the Church of England, many of them have started to drift outside of orthodoxy. And so we're starting to see a drift towards Unitarianism at the time, which is connected to a lack of the theological education. And so, interestingly, around the first 20 years or so of the 18th century, from the year 1700, orthodoxy is maintained most clearly by the Anglicans, the guys who are getting the education. But the Puritan movement has just died off, and that's because theologically, in terms of education, it's just been choked off. And there's a lesson there for us that, as I see exciting movements in terms of mission in Europe, if we don't have good investment in theological education, we will see evangelical churches and agencies, evangelical movements, theologically thin. Churches theologically thin, flimsy, fickle, and blown around. And therefore, it's not just for us, it's for everything we're standing for here. We have to ensure the robustness and the accessibility, the viability of good theological education for the health of everything we're seeing this week. This is what's ensuring that. This is providing the muscle for that. And let me talk then about a few issues that I think will help us have a viable and robust all-round theological education today. I've got, there's a handout if you want, where there's some notes if you want on the app, but don't worry about it. The first thing I want to address is the question of training and education. What do I mean by this? Well, today the language of training has largely trumped the language of education. And I think there are a few reasons for this. I think a little bit of that combination of anti-intellectualism and chasing the market, bluntly, has led to a prioritizing of practical vocational equipping over theological education. And what I mean by chasing the market is, let's say you're management of a seminary, and you see, our intake of theology students, those who actually want to study theology, is dipping, but everyone wants to study something vaguely associated. Or they want to study something vocational and practical. We'll deal with those things, but we won't teach theology so much. Right? There's no problem with equipping. We need equipping in specifics, but to mean that we step back from theological education is highly problematic. And it's concerning today because it means that this dominant language of training over education means that it affects what we're seeking to do in raising up leaders. By prioritizing training over education, I'm not down on training, we need training, but by prioritizing training over education, there are going to be a few problems. And let's think through what those problems are. Well, I started to think, first of all, what is theology? Theology is a language, a means of discourse about God. It's about knowing God. Now, that means that theology cannot primarily be practical. And that's okay. It will actually be highly practical secondarily. Because theology, bringing us to know God better, to know his ways, to know his world, to know ourselves theologically as Scripture teaches us, is going to be more deeply transformative than learning skills. And here I think is that perhaps the greatest concern I have with training over equipping. Augustine, in the early 5th century, used to a few times compare two important words in theology. And the two words were using and enjoying. And you need to get those two words right and get the objects of those two words right. He said that, properly speaking, we are only supposed to enjoy God, and everything else is used to enjoy him. And what he means by that is we use something as a means to another end. Right, so I get in a car, I use a car to get home. Right, home is my destination, so I can enjoy being with my wife. Right, so I'm using the car to enjoy time with my wife. I do not use my wife. Right, I'm enjoying time with my wife. Until we talk about a higher sense, Augustine would say, actually, you do use all creatures in order to enable you to enjoy God. So in that sense, I even use my wife in my enjoyment of her to enjoy God. As I enjoy her, it brings me to a greater enjoyment of God. But the problem with a confusion between training and equipping is that we can bring people to know practical skills and therefore finding themselves using God to enjoy ministry of some sort. And any time you've got to that place, and this is always a problem in any sort of Christian ministry, when you've got to that place where you are using God for some other end, you know something's gone catastrophically wrong. There is a danger of using God as the tool of our trade. And that's the biggest fear with training-led language. So we need to have theological educators who grasp what theology is, what education is, and what training is, and to value all three for what they are. That theology, the knowledge of God, is to bring us to worship. And that means that as we're concerned with theology, we'll look at this in a bit more detail in a moment. As we're concerned with theology, we must be concerned with discipleship and not teaching a right theology if I'm not drawing people to worship God, to love him, adore him, rightly speaking, as Scripture speaks, to fear him. I'm not speaking correctly, unless the theology is transformative in that sense. And we also need to understand that in grasping what education is, that education, knowledge, is a basic human need, not mere equipping. We need to know, and especially know God. Having said all that, of course, there are practicalities of ministry that church leaders are going on to, that seminaries, not university so much, but seminaries do need to deal with. Meaning that in terms of theology, theological education, we need to be looking at a rounded discipleship which is forming students' head, heart, and hands, if I can put it like that. There's a change in their thinking, they're being renewed in their minds, and so renewed in their hearts and character and convictions, and equipped practically in their hands to go out and do the task. And any theological education that's not doing all three is going to be stunted, limited in some way.
Thank you for listening to Delighting in the Trinity. If this podcast has encouraged you and you would like to stay in touch with the ministry of Michael Reeves, then we would love to invite you to become a friend of Union. On signing up, you'll receive a free book from Union Publishing. Then you'll receive regular exclusive devotional material from us. You'll also have the chance to keep up with the latest news and updates from the ministry of Michael Reeves around the world. If you would like to become a friend of Union today, follow the link in the podcast description now. Thank you so much.
Let me move on to another. The importance of faithfulness in theological education. Now, I think this one is terribly easy to take for granted, and so to pass over it. But this, for all of us here, it needs to be proactively fought for. Faithfulness in theological education. Terribly easy for us to talk about what are the needs, what are specifics to get into, without us talking about the ongoing need to fight for faithfulness, orthodoxy. I remember a few years ago when I took over my present role as seminary president, I got lunch with a president of a seminary, a very large seminary, and he'd been there as president for 33 years or something. And so I thought, here's a golden opportunity to say, I've just started the job. What would a very experienced guy in the role teach the new boy? And the very first thing he said is, the most important thing for you is to fight for orthodoxy. That's the most important. It won't always feel the most urgent thing, but it is the most important thing. That's going to mean different things for us according to what our roles are. For me as a leading a seminary, it means hiring faculty, hiring good faculty who are robust in their theology and orthodox in their theology, who will also be helpful in forming students in the right way. That's one of my biggest, most significant roles, one of the most significant things that I do. For faculty, of course, that's not one of the things that they do. For faculty, the fight for orthodoxy is going to be primarily around their teaching. But there is a challenge, I think, for all of us in theological education here, in this fight for orthodoxy. Especially when you're at a PhD stage, there's something good and right about chasing down interesting rabbit trails. And it's a way you grow, because you're trying to find something. Something might look like a rather arcane little thing to chase down, and actually it becomes very significant, and you can learn great things through it. There's a good thing to do that. The danger is it can get you into a habit of enjoying eccentricity and hobby horses. And so please hear me right. I don't want to say, particularly at that sort of stage, when you're trying to learn and you've got the space to be able to chase down the rabbit trails, do it. Great. You can learn great things through it. But beware of that tendency that you can cultivate a character where you enjoy eccentricity. And actually, this can even happen with a fight for a particular doctrine of the gospel. For example, I think you could so give yourself in your ministry to fight for penal substitutionary atonement that that's all you talk about. And therefore, the content of your ministry is imbalanced. That might be right, that that's your specialism, but you need to recognize that's not the whole picture. There's a need for all of us to avoid eccentricity, to have a theologically rounded whole counsel of God fight for orthodoxy. And one of the things that's going to help that is ensuring, this is particularly in seminaries, that we have a clear theological standard and that we pin our flag to it. I've had a conversation with a couple here this week in this network. Do we need statements of belief for seminaries? I'd say absolutely, yes, we do. That's important. And what that does is that pins us to where we stand theologically. And we need to work then, not just as that being something that you sign off to every year, which is a good thing to do, but there's something we can look at to go, are we in our ministry in a balanced way looking at all of that, teaching all of that? Or are we really just focusing on one or two hobby horses? After faithfulness, next thing. We need to be concerned about formation in theological education. And this is really the next step from faithfulness. This is the outworking of orthodoxy into orthopraxy and orthocardia. Now, doctrinal statements alone are not going to ensure the rounded character formation of church leaders, so we need to have additional steps in place for this. So for us, and I'm going to give a couple of our stories, if this is all right, Union stories. By the way, so I'm with Union. Dan Hames at the back is faculty with Union. Stefan's faculty with Union. Leonardo here is partnering with us in Union. So if I'm saying anything off, they can correct me or add to what I'm failing to say and pick up on it. Please do, guys. Let me tell a couple of stories about how we've tried to ensure the formation of students. One thing we've done is, on top of having a statement of faith, a theological document, we've written up Union values, which are convictions about the kind of formation that we want to be concerned with communion with God, with growth in Christ-likeness, in serving the church and in being mission-minded. So having something like a values statement alongside a doctrinal statement can help that. That's one way. That's how we've proceeded. Also, you need to work carefully in curriculum planning. And if you don't do broader curriculum planning, this means any teaching you do, you need to be thinking about this. How does what is taught ensure the broad, rounded formation of students so that they're not just geeks who understand a particular topic, but they're actually formed, I'm talking seminaries here, they're formed to be church leaders who use that knowledge to glorify God and grow his church. Let me think of an example from an earlier incarnation of mine. I used to teach Hebrew for a while. And in teaching Hebrew, that could be seen as a non-practical subject. I always worked in every grammatical lesson I was teaching from week one. I was always working to see how are the grammatical lessons that we're learning here, or the lessons we're learning, the vocab, whatever it is we're learning. How is that going to help the students who are in this class love God's word more and be drawn to love him more and love his people more? And that can be done in every single subject, but there needs to be a conscious effort to do it. And it's so easy when you're told your brief is teach Hebrew this year. It's so easy just to trot it out as a discipline without thinking of the formative, necessary formative element there. And something else we've worked very hard at being aware of, that I think everyone in theological education should be onto, is the fact that in every institution, every educational institution, there are at least two curricula, not just one. So always on the websites, looks like you've got one curriculum, and here are the modules on offer, right? So you can go onto any website. So you can go onto our union website, and you can see, for the master's course, here are the modules they teach, and you can see that. But as well as that, we'll call that the explicit curriculum. As well as that explicit curriculum, there is an important implicit curriculum, which actually functionally is just as significant in forming the students. And that is simply the values that are picked up, the theology that's picked up in every part of time in the seminary. And that means, for example, how I relate to you as I bump into you in the corridor. How I teach something in the classroom, how I engage with you over lunch, whether we're talking about theology, whether we're talking about your family. And that implicit curriculum forms, shapes, such that, for instance, if I, as a theological teacher, teach a gospel of grace, but then behave with complete arrogance and aloofness towards you, that implicit curriculum is undermining the explicit. It comes down to how faculty behave, particularly how teachers behave and treat students, what sort of community is fostered. It even comes down to the architecture, I believe. So as we've been knocking about our campus buildings, for instance, traditionally, where does the seminary president go? It's a big place, right? Big, intimidating office, right? And so you'll have the faculty offices, and then there's a big seminary president. I've deliberately got a rubbish little office. And one of the reasons for that is that there are different ways to do this, but you, just by your use of a building, you can give away the impression that the higher you go, the further you go in your career, the bigger the perks you get. And so you're teaching students to aspire for the big room, right? And so you can teach, even by your use of buildings, values, and that can sink very deep into the students. Whatever you say in terms of the theology, they've picked up how to behave. They've developed aspirations. We need to develop, let's move on. We need to develop a theological education. I've said in the handout that's mission-oriented. Another way of putting that would be to say that the whole purpose of our theological education, we must work to ensure that it's serving the church and not the institution. Church growth. That's why I say missional. And so, see, here's the problem. Institutions tend to default to self-preservation. And for seminaries, that means we'll get in the students to pay the bills. And the danger is that the institutions don't listen to the church and to its needs. And so they simply provide what they want, and the strategy becomes self-serving. And so there are two things that we need to do. Now, let me reinforce, I'm talking in my particular role, but actually this works, this can be translated into whatever role you're in. It means that we need two things. We need a church-serving vision for our ministry. We need a very clear vision of what is it you're seeking to do, to achieve. And then secondly, you need a clear strategy to achieve that vision. And I emphasize that second one because it's all very well to say, my ministry is about the evangelization of Europe. But strategically, you're doing nothing towards the evangelization of Europe. It's just a nice vision statement the donors will like. And so the strategy statement shows actually what you're really caring about. So giving yourself, giving your ministry a clear vision, church-serving vision statement, anchors your ministry to the health and growth of the church and not just to self-preservation. And the strategy ensures you're actually keeping to that practically. That won't always be most on the mind of most faculty, that sort of bigger strategy, but every part of any theological educator's ministry should be anchoring itself to a church-serving vision and a strategy to achieve that. Let me very briefly tell you about how we sought to do that, just as an example of trying to have a church-serving vision and strategy. So with Union, I took over what was a traditional campus, single campus seminary, and realized the geographical constraint and the financial constraint there, and realized that's not going to raise up enough leaders for Europe. So we went multi-locational. And the idea was, so we've now got some 27 locations, mostly church-based, and across Europe and a couple in North America as well. And in these, by being multi-locational, by being church-rooted, you're ensuring that the big campus overhead costs are stripped out so you can reduce the costs for the education so more can be educated, and you're reducing the geographical problem so that people can get there. So we've got hubs in Athens and Rome with Leonardo, as well as in around the UK and North America. And so there was a vision seeking to grow Christ's church, and the strategy is let's remove the geographical and financial constraints, and by working in partnership with churches, it changed the content we were delivering to make sure it was truly useful for where they're at, rather than simply doing the stuff we like doing. We're actually asking partners, what is it that's most needed for raising up leaders where you are? Then there's a need, my last little bit, there's a need to develop a coherence of strategy. And you need to then look at what you're doing and reorganize the ministry so as to be coherent in serving the vision. And let me give you a little bit on how we've done that. And I think I'd love you to think how you can translate that to your context. So for us, it was an important shift from saying, from using seminary language, we're about producing graduates. It was an important shift to saying, no, we're about raising church leaders. Right? It's a different thing you're aiming to do. And we shifted from there, we're not just about raising church leaders, we shifted to have a more coherent strategy, saying we're about working with church partners to recruit and raise and deploy and ongoingly support church leaders. So what I meant practically for our strategy is, for example, we found there are students who Let's say student A wants to plant a church. He's got no theological education. We wouldn't know about him, but a church partner would. Together, we can help find this guy, raise him up, give him a degree, a master's, whatever it is. And we can raise him with help on the ground, with church partners on the ground. We can deploy him effectively. And then we can put him in contact with our donors so that donors can help financially enable him to go out and plant a church. So do you see a really coherent strategy there for achieving the vision of growing the church through raising leaders?
You've been listening to Delighting in the Trinity with Michael Reeves, brought to you by Union. Union is devoted to growing leaders and growing churches. Our School of Theology equips leaders for ministry. Union Publishing supplies them and their churches with quality theological resources and books. Union Mission supports and financially helps church planting and revitalization. And Newton House, Oxford, invests in the next generation of theologians and scholars. Our vision is to see leaders and their churches the world over reformed and renewed in the gospel of Jesus Christ. To find out about our courses and learning communities around the world, to buy Union books, to discover support for your church plant, or to become a friend of Union and support our ministry, visit www.theola.gy.